You might call this some of the popular music of the day, one of the dance tunes a fiddler might play at a pub, or even, as James Muldowney is doing here, he's playing down in the Newkirk Tunnel Mine in Tomaqua, as he might have done for his fellow miners, to entertain them and while away the waiting time. That's according to George Corson, who recorded the tune for the Library of Congress in the 1940s. This is, again, James Muldowney of Pottsville in Schuylkill County. There are others, our contemporaries, who have been keeping the tradition of miners like Muldowney and others alive for decades. Jay Smarr, for example, also from Schuylkill County.
1, 2, 3.
He's not only a musician, he does a little dancing too.
I am an old coal miner, working these mines all day. Now I kind of feed my family on hardly any pay, on hardly any pay. I come into this country, a boy of 12, no man. To work as a stone picker, so they'd be boss man. I dream I'd be boss man.
Muldowney's reel and Smarr's tune here about his grandfather, I Am an Old Coal Miner.
A little house I got me on land and by the mine, and when I get my wages, take they the share of mine, take they the share of mine.
Of course, there are many other types of popular music, not just tunes with folk roots of this kind. There's been rock and roll developing in the late 40s, the late 50s, performed in Schuylkill County by the likes of the Jordan Brothers. Rock and roll electrifying not only other musicians, but creating diehard fans like Maxim Furyk, who went on to become a music journalist based in the coal region and the author of a popular study, The Jordan Brothers, A Musical Biography of Rock's Fortunate Sons. Coal and rock and roll came together in Maxim Furyk's life as he was drawn to an event here in Schuylkill County that made headlines around the world. As he tells it, in 1963, three miners were entombed more than 300 feet underground near Shepton, Pennsylvania. Although two were eventually rescued, the other simply disappeared in the course of the two-week ordeal. Interestingly, there was a rock band from the region named The Boys, B-U-O-Y-S, and they recorded a song titled Timothy that had eerie echoes of the events at Shepton. Exploring all these threads, Maxim Furyk has written a book titled Shepton, The Myth, Miracle, and Music, and he will be the guest presenter on Sunday, January 8th, at 7 p.m. at the Plymouth Historical Society with a program titled The Shepton Mine Disaster, August 1963, as part of a regional observance of Mining History Month in northeastern Pennsylvania. Maxim Furyk paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about Shepton and his life as a music journalist and historian.
As a teenager, I would listen to a record And then I would flip it over and see what the B-side was. And I had a book, and I would write down the A-side and who the writers were, the label, and then the B-side. And I was just into that. I mean, for some reason, that was important to me. And I didn't know anybody else like that until decades ago. I ran into Eddie Collins. He was from Pottsville. And he shared that same love and passion for music and for the writers, for the whole thing. So I think with me, if my dream would have come true, I would have had a Stratocaster and been on stage with a band. But, you know, in psychology, they talk about sublimation. So since I never did that, I did the second best thing. I wrote about it. And that was something that I'm proud of, because as a resident of northeastern Pennsylvania, I was able to document, well, first of all, in 1980, I had a publication called Timothy. And Timothy's purpose was to promote regional talent here in northeastern Pennsylvania. And we had interviews with Hall & Oates, with Wendy Williams and the Plasmatics, with a whole bunch of people. So that was short-lived, and then that became the Pennsylvania Musician and also the Maryland Musician. So at least, you know, we sort of were the genesis of that. In 1986, I published a book on a group called the Jordan Brothers. The Jordan Brothers were from Frackville in Schuylkill County. They were the first group to release the song Gimme Some Lovin'. Now, even though Spencer Davis and Little Stevie Winwood had written the song, and Little Stevie was like a white Ray Charles, I mean, that booming, wonderful, raw voice. And the Jordan Brothers put out Gimme Some Lovin'. It did well in places like Boston and Baltimore. It was an R&B feel. But with the Spencer Davis group, they had what almost like Phil Spector's Wall of Sound. It was just like overly produced. They had the wah-wah singers and the drums and the percussion, the congas, just everything. They threw everything at them. And certainly back in the 60s, anything with that Mercy beat trumped any American sounds. And there's so many examples of that. But the Jordan Brothers, Gimme Some Lovin', you know, trumped by Spencer Davis Group. You know, just one example. And the book has been doing well. The book's been out since 1986. And I can't say enough about it. It's been my most successful endeavor, I think mainly because I've been able to tap into that demographic. So that was the key there.
And so all along then, you have books, but you also continue to do the journalistic essay and reports and so forth.
Yeah, I define myself as a rock journalist, or maybe I mute that down and call it a music journalist. But I've been able to do that. I'm writing a series of articles for Counselor, the magazine for addiction and behavioral health specialists, and I pretty much focus on celebrity. I conjured up a term, celebrity blood voyeurism, and it's the public's fixation on celebrities, especially those that crash and burn, whether it's Michael Jackson or Amy Winehouse or Philip Seymour Hoffman. And I'm writing a book on that. I'm having it published in Counselor piecemeal, but I have the middle completed. I just need the intro and the conclusion. And I think that's going to be a fascinating read. But again, it follows my same theme of rock journalism. And, you know, I had always hoped to write for Rolling Stone or Crawdaddy. And that never happened. But I did write for Goldmine and Record Collectors Monthly and a whole bunch of other publications. And unfortunately, the reality is that these magazines like Rolling Stone, they have their own stable of writers that they assign to interview, you know, Mick Jagger and Keith Wood and everybody else. So that's the reality of it. I did come close with Crawdaddy. I thought I was going to be able to write for them. But a lot of times if the magazines aren't producing, then what they do is they fire the entire slate of writers and get new blood just to try to inject some new vitality into that. So, but I think I've had a successful career as a rock journalist. And it's just like I'm living the dream. It's just a wonderful thing to do that. You know, I've met a lot of interesting people.
What about the internet now? Has that made it possible for you to get your material up? Can we go to a website, for example, and read?
Absolutely. My website is sheptonmyth.com, S-H-E-P-P-T-O-N, myth.com. And you could read about my three books, about some of the trainings that I do for the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs, and just some of the other things that I've done. So I have two bios. One is my psychology bio as a former psychologist, and then the music journalist, the rock journalist bio. So it's kind of fun to wear a couple of hats. I mean, blessed is the person who does what he or she, you know, was born to do. And I consider myself as a rock journalist. I mean, I'm in the same school with George Graham and Joe Middleton and Richard Chizak. Jack Smiles, Eddie Ackerman, there's so many of us that did that before it was appreciated and looked at, upon as having value. And then we had a number of other journalists of late that, you know, they were able to do their articles on a regular basis. And I think that the genre has now come into its own and has that respectability driven by baby boomers. Because it was that music, it was the records that bonded us. It was like a communal thing, a tribal thing. And back in the day, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, we would get together and listen to the album and then flip it and listen to it again and talk about it and then play the cuts that we liked the best. But it was something that today's generation may not be able to experience because of the internet taking them into other places. I think that maybe we were closer back then. We bonded over music. And even today, I think music is what defines us baby boomers.
Those of us of a certain age certainly remember the rock angle, but this is a fascinating story that you're telling in connection with Shepton, which made news around the world, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It's one of the biggest stories of the year of 1963. But I approached Shepton again as a rock journalist. I was enthralled. I was intrigued by the allegations of cannibalism. Three men were entombed for 2 weeks. Only two came out. And there were people that believed that cannibalism actually occurred down in that mine. And I interviewed people from Shepton, from Oneida, from Pottsville, from the Hazleton area. And many people to this day believe that, you know, that's one of the schools of thought, one of the theories. And then 8 years later, a group from Wilkes-Barre, the boys, came out with a song called Timothy. And many people felt that Timothy was about Shepton. Now, in 1980, I had the chance to interview Rupert Holmes, the singer-songwriter, and Rupert said, no, it wasn't about Shepton, but yes, it was about a boy. They cannibalized a boy in the mine. So it was about cannibalism. A lot of things happened. Scepter Records claimed that they were embarrassed about this controversy. Now, I don't believe that for a second, because controversy drives sales, especially with teenagers. But they did a couple of things. First, Scepter Records changed the record. They bleeped out, there was a tag, hungry as hell, no food to eat. So they bleeped out the word hell. And then the other lyric was, our stomachs were full as they could be. And they changed that lyric. So they had a second version of Timothy to sort of sanitize it, to whitewash it. You know, teenagers aren't fools. They knew what was happening. They didn't buy into this. And so Scepter Records thought that they could make some money out of this and promote it. So they had contests. Who was Timothy, a canary, a mule, or a boy? And they did this in Cashbox and Record World, Billboard, you know, the trade publications. The other thing that happened, too, was that the boys would go around the country and do these interviews, and they would give different stories, and they would just confuse everybody. So the one thing, they were on, it might have been KDKA out in Pittsburgh, and they were supposed to tell the disc jockey the real story, and they didn't, and they were almost run out of town because they didn't come through with what they said they would. But they had a whole lot of fun with the controversy, and Timothy was out there for something like 17 weeks. It peaked at number 17, and it started slow. It sort of had a sound like Shocking Pink, Venus was her name. So the song came out. And then it sort of flatlined, but then people started to listen to the lyrics, and they started to say, especially college kids and teenagers, have you heard the lyrics? You know what this is about? So people started to talk about that cannibalism. It became a grotesque thing for 1971. But in comparison to 2016 with zombies and the undead and all this other stuff, you know, it was nothing for the time. And this was the time during Vietnam. There were a lot of body bags that we saw on TV, a lot of horrible things. So it might not have been as shocking in retrospect as people may think. But it was a wonderful story. Again, the reason that I wrote Shepton was for two reasons. One, because as a teenager in 1963, I was enthralled with that Shepton mythology, the possibility that maybe there was cannibalism. And I wanted to write about this. The other thing was, again, as a baby boomer, the boys were the first regional band to have a huge national hit. And I wanted to document that for myself, for posterity for fellow baby boomers. So that's what I, and mission accomplished. I did it. So.
And don't you think that's what gives Shepton maybe an afterlife? There are people who were growing up and remember the song, Timothy. Oh, yeah, Shepton.
That's part of it. But I think that the thing that makes Shepton intriguing is that, if I may, I think Shepton's significant for many reasons. It's difficult to define because it resonates on numerous levels, including themes of the miraculous and the supernatural. Shepton has themes of cannibalism and then the popular culture with the song Timothy. It had the technology that they later used in Kew Creek and in Chile at the Chilean copper mine. It's current because of that technology that is still the go-to technology, the borehole technology. The religious miracles. Felon and Throne believe that Pope John the 23rd was in the tomb with them for 2 weeks. They believe that he saved their lives, and Vatican scholars and academics have cited Shepton as one of the Pope's miracles. So that's important. And then also there were elements of the supernatural. After they came out of the mine, Felon told Throne to keep his mouth shut. Don't tell them what you saw. And Throne, who was 28, Felon was 58, Throne started to talk about the humanoid creatures that they saw, the golden cities, a lot of very bizarre things. And so the Associated Press and all of the magazines had a field day with that. But there have been other mining disasters where more lives were lost. Knox and Jeansville are examples. But with Shepton, the 14-day ordeal has captivated, it's resonated on so many different levels. And it's different because Shepton has been pronounced a continuous collective hallucination. It's been called an out-of-body experience, a miracle by Pope John the 23rd, and also proof of life after death. There's different schools of thought about what happened in Shepton. You could believe that it was hallucinations and PTSD, or you could believe that there were things of the miraculous and the supernatural. Fate magazine described Shepton as unmatched in the annals of psychic research. The Associated Press called Shepton one of the most significant news stories of the year. And of course, it was surpassed only by the assassination of our beloved President John Kennedy in November of 63. So I contend that Shepton is still current. It remains greater than the sum of its parts. Shepton lies outside of the scientific realm of understanding. It lies between the natural order and that of the supernatural. And I believe that Shepton will forever remain the Coal Region's last remaining mystery and the forbidden urban legend. And that's what my book is about.
Music journalist and historian Maxime Furyk talking about his book, Shepton, the Myth, Miracle, and Music. Maxime Furyk will be the guest presenter on Sunday, January 8th at 7 p.m. at the Plymouth Historical Society with a program titled The Shepton Mine Disaster, August 1963. And that's part of a regional observance of Mining History Month in northeastern Pennsylvania. The event is free and open to the public. For more information, you may check Maxime Furyk's website, sheptonmyth.com, S-H-E-P-P-T-O-N, myth.com. And the book is titled Shepton, the Myth, Miracle, and Music. And you can attend a program at which Maxime Furyk will be guest presenter this Sunday, January 8th at 7 in the evening at the Plymouth Historical Society. The program is titled The Shepton Mine Disaster, August 1963, part of a regional observance of Mining History Month in northeastern Pennsylvania. The event is free and open to the public. For more information on the web, sheptonmyth.com, sheptonmyth.com. We'll continue our conversation with Maxime Furyk about the Shepton Mine disaster. That's tomorrow on Art Scene.